4, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is being held virtually by Zoom, and the public has been properly noticed and notified of the options to attend and observe the meeting. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr.
Present.
Dinar? Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davy? Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you. Remarks and announcements. Please note that any times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at a scheduled time, but the board may suspend the discussion of any item, move to a different item, and then come back to the former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. Board members, thank you very much for the use of the raise hand feature. I think that helps all of us, so please continue doing that. Board survey, the board encourages people to who are in attendance to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form, which you can find on the agenda. There's a link that you can go to. I want to recognize all of the board members for all of the hard work that goes into getting prepared for these meetings. And sometimes, you know, there are these issues that stay with you. You're thinking even if you're not actively looking at documents. So I really appreciate, you know, the kind of thinking, the thought process that goes into getting prepared for these meetings. And also I want to thank our staff for, you know, the hours and hours of work that they invest in getting all of us prepared, you know, getting all of the documents to us, doing all of the due diligence, making sure if we have any questions they're answered. It really, you know, takes a village. And then the tip of the iceberg is, you know, these meetings that last a few hours, but there's, you know, a lot of stuff that happens between the meetings. I really appreciate everyone's you know, attention and hard work. In terms of continuing legal education, the board meeting is eligible for continuing education credits, but only if it lasts for 4 hours, at least 4 hours, and you know, maybe this meeting will not. So you know, you have sort of advance notice of that. If it does last for more than 4 hours, then we'll provide you code words during the meeting. Please keep a note of them, and then you can report those code words to the board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit. Look for the link on the board meetings page for the link for that. Call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request in advance permission to speak. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable time on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. According to ARS Section 38-431.02, subsection H, the board can only take action on matters actually listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda, if applicable. So if you wish to speak, please unmute right now, and you can state your name, and I'll then call upon you. Hearing none, let's go to number five on the agenda, council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any update for the board?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I do not have an update at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Moving on to the consent agenda, number six, are there any recusals? Hearing none, is there any, yes, Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I'll need to recuse myself from item number seven, please.
Thank you. So seven actually is not on the consent agenda, so we'll note your recusal, but for purpose of the consent agenda, is there any anything on that you need to recuse from, Dr. Seidman?
No,
Okay.
thank you.
Thank you. Any other recusals? Does any board member wish to pull an item out of the consent agenda for further discussion? Hearing none, is there a motion?
So moved.
To approve. Thank you, Dr. Medina. Second by Dr. Stenhoff. I think you said second, but okay. So Dr. Medina makes the motion. Dr. Stenhoff seconds. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. So actually, let's skip to number 16, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding granting authorization to executive director and board member designee or designees to engage in settlement conference discussions concerning cases 2407 and 2408 as they relate to respondent Jamie Jones. Ms. Packnin, will you please provide a summary to the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your approval to add this agenda item to today's meeting, which was completed about 45 hours ago. So that's, in compliance with the open meeting law, we were able to accommodate this this discussion. I won't, in my summary, go into the substance of the cases because of the status of the cases. So what I will say is that with respect to cases 2407 and 2408, the respondent is Jamie Jones, a behavior analyst. Just in terms of the history of these cases, back in December, the board had voted to extend to Ms. Jones a consent agreement that prescribed, that adopted certain findings of fact and conclusions of law and prescribed some corrective actions relative to what was identified in those cases. At that time, Ms. Jones, after considering the board's proposal, came back with a counter proposal. The counter proposal was enough of a departure from what the board voted on, in terms of the conclusions of law and the elements of the order. It was so much so that board staff elected at that time that the matter should be scheduled for an informal interview. And so that was scheduled and noticed. More recently, Ms. Jones has obtained alternative legal counsel, and the election that Ms. Jones has made instead is to forego the informal interview option or opportunity and instead request a formal hearing. So the cases are in formal hearing status. This means that there has been, a change in terms of Ms. Galvin's role changes, and we now have an independent advisor assigned to this board to provide legal advice. And so that's why you see Mr. Mark Harris today. So on Wednesday morning, the parties to the cases met to discuss, really some procedural matters around the scheduling and possible timing of the formal hearing, targeting June, ideally as that time frame. But the discussion opened the door to the possibility that the parties may come together and negotiate a settlement agreement in lieu of the hearing. And so we have some time and opportunity to do that. But what we're asking for the board to approve today is for the board to authorize certain individuals, certain agents of this board to engage in the negotiations and act on behalf of the board, at least, in a negotiation sense. Some boards authorize or just grant blanket authorization, if you will, to the staff, to the senior staff, executive director, and so forth. This board really hasn't done that, but you can do it, of course, on a case-by-case basis, as this item suggests. So Perhaps the recommended strategy here is for the board to consider authorizing me and then a member of the board to engage in those negotiations. For obvious reasons, it's less wieldy than the negotiations happening before the full board. So that designee from the board could be either the board chair or an alternative member of the board, perhaps someone with expertise that would be, beneficial to the process. So I can answer questions that you have relative to my summary. I do think that many of the questions, anticipating your questions are going to be most appropriate, though, for Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen, for that summary, and thank you for making it possible for us to have this item on today's agenda, as opposed to, sometime in a future meeting. And thank you, Mr. Harris, for providing us your expert legal support on this. I actually want to make a motion to go into executive session for discussing confidential health information and to receive legal advice.
Second
by Dr. Medina. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Good morning. Somebody has music playing in the background. If you could please mute that. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. I was mute. I was on mute. It is 9:44 a.m. and we are back in open session. Ms. Poe, will you please do a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
Thank you. We have quorum. And Chairman Dinar, I believe Ms. Pakkinen may have alerted you after this agenda item. There is a call to the public. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll go back to it. We are still on number 16. So on that, is there any discussion or a motion? I'm prepared to make a motion if there is no discussion. So I'll make a motion to authorize our executive director and two board members of our choosing to participate in settlement discussions with Ms. Jones and her attorney if she has legal representation. And part of that settlement discussion, Ms. Galvin would be involved in that as well.
Second.
Motion and a second. In terms of discussion, I would ask, or at least my preference would be to have our behavior analyst professional members participate in that settlement negotiation. I'm sorry. I'm sort of I'm voluntelling Dr. Stenhoff and Dr. Davey, but I think those are the best qualified members to attend. Dr. Stenhoff, your hand is up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to participate in that too. I know we're being voluntold, so to speak, but happy to
thank,
do it.
Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. And Dr. Davey, I realize you weren't part of the executive session, but in the executive session, we had given, as a board, direction to the designees as to what needs to happen in the settlement negotiation. So I'm sure if Ms. Pakkinen is comfortable with my recommendation to involve Dr. Davey, in light of the fact that he did not attend the entire executive session, if that's okay, then, that that second designee would be Dr. Davey.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, members of the board, if we could just make sure that the motion reflects those two individuals as the board's designees as participating in the settlement conference, please.
Yes, I'll modify my motion to include Dr. Stenhoff and Dr. Davey as the participants or board's designees. Dr. Davey.
My second. I was just going to accept that. I will get brought up to speed. I am aware of the agenda item and have reviewed the materials, so I'd be happy to be a part of that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. So there's a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And then my second motion is to authorize the board designees to engage in settlement conference with Ms. Jones as was directed in the executive session.
Second.
Is a second by Dr. Catarino. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Chairman Diner, this is Ms. Poe. I'm just noting that Dr. Davey is now present for the record in the meeting. Thank you.
And I would just note that I've recused myself from both of those votes.
Thank you. So I'll note for the record, there were Dr. Davey was recused from each of those two motions. So going back to the call to the public, if you're here, please unmute yourself and I'll call upon you to make a statement.
Hi, I had a statement / question that I was hoping the board could address.
Yes, please. Yeah, you can introduce yourself and make your statement. Thank you.
Sure. My name is Charlie Manning. I was told that this was the right forum to bring up two questions that I have regarding licensing regulations for applied behavior analysts. First, I was wondering if there was anything from a licensing perspective that requires applied behavior analysts to be employed by a licensed provider, like a psychiatrist. Second, for applied behavior analysts providing therapies in client homes, do you know if there's a particular entity license, like a home health agency license, that would be required?
Thank you for those questions. You can maybe follow up with our board staff as to, you know, what needs to happen, but we can't comment in a public meeting on this item because it wasn't agendized. But thank you again for your statement.
Mr. Manning, because that particular topic is not on the agenda, the board can't answer those questions, but staff would be happy to discuss that with you if you reach out to the director, Ms. Pekkanen, on Monday or after this meeting. She would be happy to, you know, give you whatever information she can.
Will do. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you again. Any other member of the public wants to make a statement? All right, then we'll move on to number 7, if that's all right, Ms. Pekkanen. All right, number 7 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding psychologist licensure application from Emily Berry PsyD to include review of her self-report of criminal charges, review of the results regarding the updated psychological fitness for duty evaluation, and possible denial of the same. I'll note for the record that Dr. Seidman is recused from this matter as he completed Dr. Berry's first evaluation. I don't expect he'll need to be invited into any executive session for purposes of discussing that evaluation, since the board now has a more current evaluation, but if the question comes up, I'm sure Ms. Galvin can advise us about that. So Ms. Pekkanen, will you please provide a summary to the board?
I certainly will, Mr. Chair. And if for some reason we do need Dr. Seidman, I can always send a text message to notify him that we will be inviting him to an executive session. So he's welcome to, as I see, he's turned off his video, so he's properly recused, but I can alert him if he's needed. So in terms of this application, so in essence, the substantive review of the application continues. You most recently had an opportunity to review some recently gathered facts during your February 9th board meeting. And so one of the expectations that the board had articulated and the licensee had agreed to was that an updated evaluation, a more current evaluation in light of new events, new criminal charges and so forth, would be very helpful, would be informative. And so Dr. Berry did follow through with submitting to that evaluation, and you have the report in your packet, which I think is a very comprehensive report and should, better illuminate your understanding of this matter. So very recently, 12 hours ago or so, new information also came to board staff, and unfortunately not in enough time really for us to gather everything that we would have ideally done for, to inform the board today. But staff did just sort of as a due diligence exercise, reviewed the current status of Dr. Berry's certification as a school psychologist. So the Arizona Department of Education certifies those professionals, and Dr. Berry has been certified in that capacity for quite some time. And we did see that back in August of 2023, there was some disciplinary action taken, which amounts to a suspension of her certification under conditions. We don't know any information beyond that because any sort of, public document or documents representing the facts and the actions taken and so forth, they weren't posted online in the sense that our agency does. So we've reached out to the department to gather those facts. And so, the board may want to suspend, making any decisions today until you have more information. But in essence, the application remains in the same status that it did back in February, which is, a documented history of some open, some unresolved, some closed and resolved instances of her criminal history. The impairment questions still are unresolved or still need some evaluation and some decisions on the part of the board. I think the board has had maybe limited opportunities to really engage effectively with Dr. Berry. And so you may have questions for her. I see she's here today. And of course her attorney Flynn Carey is as well. I'm sure that they want to make statements to the board and represent, what they were, what they would like the board to consider moving forward. So any questions about this summary, I think, before you shift into the questions that you likely want to ask?
Any questions for Ms. Pakkanen? Dr. Cadrino?
So Ms. Pakkanen, to clarify, you did note that Ms. Berry has a school psych certificate and the year in which it was given. How many years has she had it?
Ms. Folks, do you have that information? I know that her certification extends back for quite some time. I'm remembering, maybe correctly or incorrectly, from 2010. To the present. But again, that action was taken in a little over 6 months ago in August of 2023. So we are still, gathering the information about what we do know is it suggests that there were, cases that were potentially opened in 2021 and in 2023. So Mr. Carey may have, some information for us today. But, you know, of course, the documents are going to be, you know, tell the complete story. And we don't have those because we only learned of these actions late yesterday. And we have no expectation the department will be able to supply them this quickly.
Okay, was this was it documented on her initial application that she had this certification? Isn't there a line for that on the application? Do you have other certificates? Or
yes, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Caterina, so what you're asking is when she applied and she indicated on her application that she holds a certification from the Department of Education as a school psychologist, that was verified by Ms. Folks, you know, during the administrative processing timeframe and substantiated by the board in the, I'm sure, the initial ARC review of the application. At that time, there was no adverse action issued by the Department of Education. It's the actions that we very recently discovered have been much more recent than, you know, the time Dr. Berry applied back in 2021.
And
what we don't know is that, you know, we don't know the timing relative to, you know, was she aware of an investigation in 2021 prior to having applied, or is the opposite true? She applied and the investigation was open. So those are facts that still need to be gathered. And again, Mr. Carey may give the board, you know, some insights, some preliminary information, and then we take it from there.
Is the applicant required to contact the board if there's an investigation or only if there's discipline by another board?
Let's leave that question, I think, Dr. Caterina, for Ms. Galvin to address.
Okay. So let's actually turn to Mr. Carey and Dr. Berry. Thank you both for being here. You may wish to make a statement or submit to the board's questions.
Sure. Chair Dinar, members of the board, just to answer, to piggyback on what Heidi said, since I know this was relevant for Dr. Caterino, her certificate was granted August 19th of 2016. She also held a provisional structured immersion language or English immersion endorsement in which lapsed in 2011. She had a standard professional elementary K through 8 certificate that lapsed in 2014, and she had a provisional K through 8 that lapsed in 2008. And the basis for the board's actions were based for the DOE Department of Ed's were all based on the DUI conduct. As I explained to Heidi this morning when we chatted briefly. With the Department of Ed, when a fingerprint is taken of a license holder or a certificate holder, it's communicated to the DOE. That happens with DOE and with real estate. So both of them will get noticed. So that's what prompted their investigation. And I don't know exactly when the investigation was made known to Ms. Berry, but what I can say is according to the materials from the DOE, they started their investigation in 2023. I don't have, just because I'm a little bit of in a rush since Heidi and I talked right before the meeting, I don't have the date when the board, the Department of Ed started its investigation, but it was definitely in 2023.
They notified Dr. Berry that they were investigating her?
There was a notification, but the notification would not have gone out right away. I've had a few of these, Dr. Caterino, when I do teacher representation, that there's a significant period of time before they provide a notification. I don't know the timing of that just because I didn't have the time to go back to my notes on it because of the timing of when Heidi and Kathy mentioned that they had this item that they wanted to bring in for the board.
Well, we could ask Dr. Berry, you know, when she was notified. Okay.
And
Carey, as to your statement, if you want to make a statement, I'm responding to some questions that came up.
Thank you, Chair Dinar. What I would just suggest is it looks like, according to the executive director, there's an interest in staff doing some additional review of the materials and getting some additional documentation. You know, this is again a case where we have an applicant, so we don't really have someone who's, you know, actively practicing under this board. So there's not a situation where necessarily there could be, you know, prejudice to the public or harm to the public. So one thing that I would suggest is if we wanted to put this on hold to allow the board staff to complete its investigation, in the interim, we kind of have the same issue that we've had before that we might want to be thinking about as well, which is she still hasn't used or done her third ECCC. You recall she was unsuccessful in the first two. The regulations do allow for a third test before some additional requirements come in. So this issue, this case may solve itself if she's unsuccessful. And I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm just saying that may be an easy way to address this. If she's unable to complete the ECCC, then you really aren't going to need to necessarily continue down this road because she will have used all three of her ECCCs at that point. So that's always an option, which is put this on hold so that Ms. Pakkinen and Ms. Fowkes can do their completion of their investigation on their side of the house, have Emily continue forward doing the ECCC. The evaluation will keep, obviously, and she's already taking on a lot of the recommendations made by the new clinician who evaluated her. And as we've indicated, she's already in some monitoring and taking some other steps. So it might be, there might be an instance here where just given sort of the totality of circumstances, we want to take a collective breath here. That would be my suggestion here. We're already, it's already an old application, and I don't know that a month or two, you know, one direction or the other is going to necessarily change the landscape significantly. Such that it would prejudice anyone. So it may be that may be the best approach at this point.
Any questions for Mr. Carey or Dr. Berry?
And Chair, if I may, I did forget to mention that, you know, the other thing that I don't recall if you raised it, but one of your colleagues may have raised it, that the case is still pending in Superior Court on that one matter. The one that's still active. So that's the other benefit of potentially bumping this out a bit. Right now, she's set for pretrial in June. So we might, prior to that, get a resolution on the case. And if so, then obviously that's going to be very probative for the board as well.
Dr. Medina and then Dr. Flint.
I wanted to request to go into executive session to receive legal advice.
Okay, that's a motion. I'll second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. None opposed, the motion carries. Okay, we are back in open session. It is 10:23 a.m. We are still on item number 7, but before we proceed any further, I'm going to take a comfort break of 10 minutes. We'll come back at 10:35. And we are back. Ms. Poe, will you please do a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Dr. Seidman is recused for the record on item number 7.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So we are still in item number 7 regarding Dr. Berry. So at this point, let me see if any board members have questions for Dr. Berry or Mr. Carey. Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dr. Berry. Thank you for being here. And when did you receive notice from the Department of Education that they were conducting an investigation on your certificate? You're muted.
I apologize. I do not know the exact date on that. I would have to go back and check my records.
Would you say it was
3 months ago, last week, 1 month ago?
No. It was,
roughly. I don't need an exact date, but roughly. Yesterday?
No, it was in 2023, I believe.
Okay. I have no further questions at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Flint?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is also for Dr. Barry. In 2022, it appears there were some additional charges in Highland Justice Court. Were you able to review the report done by the most recent evaluator? And is the data in that report about this incident accurate?
And has
it been resolved?
Yes.
It's accurate and has been resolved?
Correct.
Okay. May I ask why that was not disclosed on your application?
I was under the impression everything was disclosed. That's been my intention, is to have everything out there. So it's always been my intention to have everything out there. And that's been my, understanding.
Okay.
And I would note, Member Flint, that none of the violations for which she was cited are 32-3208 violations. So there's all the boards are required to maintain a list of violations that require reporting. And these were looked to be largely traffic violations for looks like a suspended license, fictitious license plate, speeding, shoulder belts, not wearing a seat belt, and vehicle registration, which is a civil violation. So it doesn't look like any of those were under 32-3208, which would have triggered the reporting obligation.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Barry and Mr. Carey. Thank you.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a follow-up question for Dr. Barry. And that is, did you not think it was relevant for this board to know about the investigation that the Department of Education was conducting on your certification as a school psychologist?
My application with this board was from 2021. So at that time, there was no upcoming investigation from the Department of Ed. And then there's been no reapplication throughout all of this where there would have been a time to disclose.
So Dr. Barry or Mr. Carey, so your position, it seems to me, is that there is no continuing obligation on you to report any changed circumstances or events that occur after the date of the application, and that shouldn't reflect one way or the other on the board's understanding of an applicant's character and fitness to be a licensed professional.
Well, Chair Dinar, my position would be that the basis upon which the Department of Ed took action was the exact same basis upon which the board here is contemplating taking action, which is the criminal DUIs. So there was no allegations related to any harm to children, anything related to professional misconduct in the sense of doing something that fell below the standard of care in relation to her performance in an educational setting. So it's exactly the same allegations. And, they handled the matter within their jurisdiction and made decisions informed by their code of their regulations and their statutes, where as this board will be looking at it from the scope of from psychology perspective.
So then my follow-up question, I still did not quite get an answer to my question, but my follow-up question is, we have had this case for many months now, and we have done at this point two evaluations, psychological evaluations. At what point do you think as an applicant who is, willing to work with the board to obtain a license and then practice in this profession, at what point does that applicant need to just come to the table with with this understanding of full disclosure. Hey, you know, these things are happening. And at that point, you know, maybe the board can take appropriate action to set the applicant up for success. But this sort of selective idea that you can selectively tell or not tell the board certain things, events that have occurred after the application occurred, well, because, you know, 3208 only talks about criminal convictions. Seems like, I mean, there is some sort of a pattern of behavior that just raises questions in the board's mind about the character of the applicant, you know, what the future as a licensed psychologist would look like given these circumstances. And this isn't a one-off thing. I mean, we have seen a pattern of this. So if you want to address this, I want to give you a chance to address that.
Well, I, from a legal perspective, the only reason I was, you know, I'm not taking the position that, you know, there should have been or shouldn't have been disclosure on that driving on a suspended license charge. The only thing I was adding to it is just from a legal perspective, the statute does not require it. I certainly think that your position of, you know, coming to the board and making full disclosure, that's obviously a different question compared to what the law does require. And that, you know, 3208, pretty clear on what it does require. So I think those are somewhat different things. From an education perspective, I mean, she does have it is a separate certification. And so it really is outside of the board's jurisdiction. It's not saying that she attempted to conceal or anything along those lines, but it wasn't directly related, at least in her opinion, to the practice of, to the licensure that she's attempting to seek here.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. So did I understand you correctly, Mr. Carey, that the citations had nothing to do with injury to children or anything like that? Is that correct?
That is correct. The basis upon which the DOE took action was on the basis of her DUIs and related criminal actions. It was not related to any sort of in-school conduct or anything involving a student or a coworker or anything like that.
But do I recall correctly that one of the citations, the aggravated DUI, that there were two children in the car? Is that not accurate?
That is accurate. That is...
How do you mesh that together?
Well, I guess I'm not following. I mean, that case has not been adjudicated. The allegation at this point is that it was an aggravated DUI because there were children in the car. Mm-hmm. The Department of Ed took their action on the basis of her DUIs. I think what I was clarifying, which I did clarify during my comments, is there's no nexus between the Department of Ed wasn't finding a nexus between actual school conduct. So I wanted to assure the board that this wasn't activity that took place like in a school setting or anything along those lines. I mean, we've certainly been very direct that the allegation is an aggravated DUI involving children in a car under the age of 15.
And am I also correct then that the officer involved in issuing the citation that reported the incident to the Department of Child Services?
I believe that in relation to that case, there was a report to DCS.
Would that not rise to a level of harm to children?
Well, again, I think that you may be conflating two things. I think my comments were the basis upon which the Department of Ed made its decisions was conduct that would discredit the teaching profession in the sense of she had a criminal history. There's nothing in the DOE's investigation that would indicate she engaged in any misconduct while in her professional setting. So there's no allegations regarding school, regarding harm to students or anything along those lines. I mean, I'm not trying to distance from the allegation that she had children in the car during a DUI, but that is specifically related to the criminal conduct. A lot of the time with the Department of Ed, when they're investigating, if they're not investigating criminal, they're investigating situations with teachers have engaged in misconduct while teaching or while providing teaching services. And I think what my comments went towards is they were not related to her professional license, her licensed activities. And we have, I mean, she did disclose and appropriately disclose the fact that she had been charged with this aggravated DUI. And based on the DUI, what the citation, it was the DUI for children under 15. So she did provide the board clear notice, your board clear notice that this is a case involving DUI and involving an allegation of children being in the car.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Sorry, I was on mute. Apologize. Ms. Gavin.
Mr. Carey, I was wondering what led to Dr. Berry being charged with driving on a suspended license? Why was her license suspended?
I do not have that information in front of me, and I believe it would be based on the fact and that she had a DUI and she drove. I don't recall if it was Emily, you can chime in. It's a resolved case, so you're allowed to share. I thought it was you were driving and your license was still in a status. And can you clarify that for Jeannie, please?
Yeah, that's correct. So I was eligible for reinstatement, but hadn't done all of the steps necessary, such as obtaining the correct insurance and different all the steps and things needed, but I was eligible for reinstatement.
Thank you.
Dr. Caterina?
You made the comment that the school psych certificate is very different than the licensing, but there is a question on the application. Yes, I know she completed it in 2021. That does ask, you know, do you have other certificates and do you have any ongoing investigations? Mm-hmm. So you would think that she might find it relevant since it was an initial question on the application to report that to the board. Because otherwise, if the board wasn't concerned about those things, it wouldn't have been a question. So it is, I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's far-fetched to think that that should have been reported.
But that,
yes,
I just wanted to say on the timeline, on the application in 2021, none of these events had occurred and no investigation was happening.
I understand that. But I mean, since you know that those are things that the board are interested in, because there's two questions about that certificate and investigation, when there were changes in that, it would be, you know, it would have been wise to come to the board and say, now I do have changes on question number this and question number that, you know? So that it would, you know, show a transparency and a willingness to be forthcoming.
So. Dr. Medina?
I would like to make a motion to go into executive session because I do have some questions in regard to treatment that I believe I cannot ask in.
Second.
And would the motion include legal advice if needed?
Yes.
My second still stands. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, this is Ms. Poe. For clarification, and am I sending Dr. Berry and her attorney in as well?
Yes.
Correct.
Yes. All right. Just a moment. Thank you.
Okay, we are back in open session and it is 11:10 a.m. Still on item number 7. Any further questions for Mr. Carey or Dr. Berry? Hearing none, let's go into our discussion phase. And as a reminder, it's a discussion amongst the board members without interruptions from anybody. So does anybody want to discuss the next steps or offer a motion, Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. I'm certainly leaning toward tabling this in order to give the board staff enough time for further investigative work. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. And that I lean in that direction as well. The thing I want to sort of state on the record is, I've seen sort of this pattern of answering a question without answering. So like, you know, we have to ask a question precisely this way for Dr. Berry to give us a precise answer that doesn't disclose anything that she does not want to disclose to us. And, you know, we certainly can give her more time and gather more information, but during the next 1 or 2 months that we are in this information gathering phase, I would strongly recommend to Dr. Berry not to engage in the same sort of pattern of, you know, not coming to the table with an open and honest intent in answering all of the questions or giving the board the information that it needs. And ultimately, as a board, we want licensees to be set up for success. But in order to accomplish that, we need your help, Dr. Berry, in making sure that we set you up for success as a future licensee of this board. So I would strongly recommend that in this time, be as forthcoming as possible. And I'm sure Mr. Carey has had dealings with the board, and I trust his coaching of you as his client in that sense. So I just wanted to mention that because, you know, sometimes things get lost in translation, and I don't want that to sort of, you know, we come back in 1 or 2 months and say, oh, we need more information and we're still tabling this and kicking the can down and it never gets resolved. Nothing moves. Any further discussion? All right, Dr. Stewart, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Downer, thank you. I move that we table this issue with this applicant in order to allow board staff sufficient time to gather additional information. And also, perhaps some of these issues will resolve one way or the other in terms of the criminal charges.
Second that, and as part of that, Dr. Stewart, I assume we are also tabling the request to take the ERPP, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So there's a motion and a second. Further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. Dr. Seidman is still recused. The motion carries. So let's go to number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning proposed corrective action plan submitted by Brittany Keeler concerning supervision of BCBA supervisees completing experience requirements to apply for Arizona licensure. And Dr. Davey is the lead on this, but before that, let me just check with staff. Was it this one, or there was a request to continue based on some emerging situation? So it's this case or some?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I think that, one of the options the board may consider in light of what the subject of this agenda item disclosed to us yesterday, her unavailability today, I think that that's, the board can consider what alternative to do. You can hear the item or you can propose an alternative. And I think Dr. Davey, probably has some thoughts around that.
Okay. Yeah, Dr. Davey, if you want to sort of maybe give us enough information so that we can evaluate whether we should table this. And, you know, so if you tell us that, you know, you would like to hear from Ms. Keeler about some questions that we have, then maybe it makes sense to table, right? So, yeah, please go ahead.
Just as a way of just a quick update to the board, you know, this really has to deal with BCBA supervision provided to individuals that were seeking licensure in the state of Arizona by end of, you know, and the supervision was provided by an out-of-state an Arizona lawyer, someone without an Arizona license in terms of supervision. And it came to light as an applicant was going through their process to become licensed in our state. And so, you know, I do think it would be helpful to have Ms. Keeler here to discuss this, but I also was going to make the recommendation that, you know, while Dr. Stenhoff and I can sit here and opine on what we believe the committee's opinion would be to this, the request for this letter was by the committee to kind of like tell us what you're doing to correct this. This is a large national, multi-state, multi-site organization that has developed a quote-unquote fellowship program that in our understanding and in our discussion with the BCBA that's based out of California came to realize that the practices that they were engaged in and the supervision they were providing into the state of Arizona definitely ran afoul of our the Practice Act part of our license. And so I would be somewhat hesitant to just adjudicate the matter, one, without Ms. Keeler here, and two, without the recommendation from the committee. So my suggestion would be to push this back to the committee. They will obviously meet prior to the next board meeting. Let the committee have a discussion about the individual's information they provided here, what they're doing in terms of responding to our concern. You know, we do have the very real fact of jurisdiction in this matter, given the California basis of this, and let the committee come back with a recommendation to the board on how it believes the full board might consider proceeding.
Thank you, Dr. Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If that's a motion, who wants to second it? I'll second it. Any further discussion?
I would just ask the board staff work to make sure that Ms. Keeley is available for the next CBA when we agendize this. Thank you.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, do you mind if we go to number 10 now? I know that the licensee's attorney is present and the licensee may have phoned in, but you know, that's an opportunity, I think, to call this item and resolve it since they've been here with us.
Yes, that's a very good suggestion. In fact, I was going to prioritize all of the sort of cases and then come back to all of the, you know, discussions. So that works perfectly. Let's go to number 10, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the Committee on Behavior Analysts' recommendation for complaint number 2427 against Elizabeth Gressard, M.Ed., or initial case review. And on this, Dr. Stenhoff is the lead. So Dr. Stenhoff, will you please provide us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Gressard was issued her behavior analyst license in May of 2022 and was required to renew it by July 31st of 2023. She failed to renew the license. In fact, continued to practice from August to October of 2023 without a license. However, immediately upon discovering that her license had expired on July 31, she emailed the board staff notifying them, and staff provided her instructions to reinstate her license. She also self-reported the BACB on October of 23, which the board reviewed it. The BACB board reviewed it and closed the case after the review. Her license was reinstated November 6th, 2023. On January 12th, the board accepted a recommendation from the Committee on Behavior Analysts to open a complaint regarding the allegation that Mr. Gressard failed to renew her license by the deadline, and also to gain clarity on the extent to which she was practicing while unlicensed. The committee requested documentation from her former employer. The employer provided some information. However, the information wasn't great information. I'll just put it that way. However, after deliberation among the committee members, they voted to recommend that the board dismiss this complaint recommend that to the board for that approval. So that ends my review. If there's any questions, feel free.
Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. Any questions for Dr. Stenhoff? Hearing none, is Ms. Gressard present? If you are, and I believe you are represented by Ms. Mandy Carvis. So if you are, I guess Angelica Davis, I apologize. I see you here. Thank you for being here. So now would be the time to make a statement and introduce yourselves, and I'm sure we'll have some questions.
I am Angelica Davis, and I am here for Mandy Carvis representing Ms. Gressard. As Dr. Davey mentioned, Ms. Gressard unintentionally had a 3-month lapse of her licensure. She was on FMLA, and she returned and rendered services to 1 to 5 clients. And immediately after learning that her license had lapsed, she submitted a application for reinstatement the following day, and she has since reinstated. There was about 3 months where she was practicing before she learned. We encourage the board to take the committee recommendation of dismissal, and Ms. Gressard is here and available to answer any questions the board may have.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Davis or Ms. Gressard? Hearing none, any discussion or motion?
I'll make a motion.
Chair. Oh. Sorry, Mr. Wood.
Oh, I was going to make a motion to dismiss complaint number
2427. Second.
All right, there is a motion and a second. It's good to see Mr. Wynn make a motion. I'm just kidding. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Davis, for being here, and thank you, Ms. Gressard, for being here as well.
Thank you, and thank you for the motion.
Thank you.
So let's go to number 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding application for ERPP and licensure from Rachel Knutson, PsyD. And on this, Dr. Medina is the lead. So Dr. Medina, would you want to give us a summary?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Flint.
I am recused from this item. I was a advisor during her program.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Medina. You can go ahead.
So this is in regards to the application by Dr. Rachel Knutson for taking the ERPP and licensure. Dr. Knutson graduated from Midwestern University, Glendale campus in 2023, which is an APA accredited program. She completed an APA accredited internship at the Arizona State Hospital and 2 pre-internship practicum placements, 1 at Centurion, 1 at Gallimore Clinical and Forensic Services. And there were training plans for both of those experiences in the self-query. Look good, so I see no issues in approving this application.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Medina? Any discussion or motion?
Dr. Nguyen. Mr. Nguyen.
Yeah, Mr. Nguyen, please.
Mr. Nguyen, go ahead.
Second one in a row, make a motion to approve this application.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? 1 recusal, Dr. Flint, the motion carries. So I think that leaves us with non-case items. Is that correct, Ms. Pakkanen? I want to take the quicker actions first. Maybe let's go to number 12. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation, including but not limited to the listed bills. And any update concerning the proposed executive budget for financial year 2025. And Ms. Pakkinen, would you please provide us a summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'll actually take this the last of the topics, if you will, first. No update relative to the proposal that we learned of in January to sweep or transfer funds away from the board's dedicated fund to resolve what is really the general fund budget deficit, the revenue deficit that is, you know, an issue. So there are conversations that are occurring, you know, negotiations at a very high level that are really initiating now more in earnest because the legislature has mostly worked through the bills that have been introduced and have progressed. And so I'll pivot to talking about really just a few of them. You know, we've already talked about the fact that two of the bills that the board, you know, supported, that they were not successful in, you know, the crossover chamber. And so we won't see those provisions implemented. And, you know, reintroduction is a possibility in a future session. But two bills that I was really struggling to envision how we might implement them, you know, just by virtue of lack of clarity, you know, some ambiguity, or just, you know, my perception of them, you know, the requirements being especially daunting. The two bills have been vetoed. So House Bill 2100 was one such bill. And what that really did was throw to me, you know, a lot of confusion into, you know, what is a administrative function with respect to identifying application deficiencies and what is a substantive deficiency and how, you know, it really it was clear that the language intended to restrict what happens at the administrative phase, which I totally respect. It just really, my concern was that it had so much of a chilling effect on staff's ability to proactively with applicants, you know, sort of encourage them to, you know, fix what are in many cases very minor fixable items. And so, you know, my concern was that the committees and the board would see, you know, a multitude, a very high percentage, an unmanageable percentage of applications that, you know, contain deficiencies that in 4 years you never see because they're handled by board staff. So that issue, you know, goes away with the veto. The other bill that, you know, I was really struggling with Senate Bill 1343. What that added to the longstanding usual defined set of requirements for a 5-year rule review that this agency is subject to. As a matter of fact, in 2022, summer of 2022, I completed that exercise for the behavior analytic rules. I just submitted the same exercise for the psychologist rules. And what it really amounts to, you respond to a series of questions in terms of, you know, do you still have the statutory authority for these rules? Are they still clear? You know, have you had any complaints about the rules? So, you know, I complete that exercise and submit it. But what it would have layered on is this requirement that agencies do an analysis of all surrounding states and the burdens, the regulatory burdens that the rules establish. So we would have had to compare every single one of our rules burdens, and that's the term that's used, against, you know, those of New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, California, yep. You know, all the places. And so, you know, it's a lot of states. And in some cases, that would have been what the exercise would have yielded is, you know, in the case of behavior analysts, because they aren't regulated in Colorado, they aren't regulated in California. So our regulatory burden, you know, is it's a big departure from, you know, what those states represent, of course. And then, you know, I had lots of questions around, well, you know, if you look at one, I think prime example of what can be construed as a regulatory burden, or that's the fee that, you know, someone pays. But that's a complex exercise because in Arizona, the fees that licensees pay, it covers the cost of everything associated with regulating that profession down to, you know, very granular levels. We don't get any general fund support for things like IT or even for HR. We pay so much, you know, out of our funds, you know, for pro rata, our 10% contribution to the general fund, ISAs, you know, to fund every single invoice that's processed, we incur a charge for that. How do we possibly compare our regulatory costs and the fees that have to cover those costs with other jurisdictions when we simply don't have that degree of insight? And how do we even do that analysis? So I found it so mind-blowingly daunting, and just the language in the statute, you know, I didn't even know how broad and deep it really was. It just could have been interpreted so many different ways. So the veto of that bill, you know, brought a sense of relief in that I don't have to worry about this tomorrow. So, you know, I can focus on some other things. Last bill that I'll talk about under this agenda item is House Bill 2686. So this is a bill that does establish, you know, some new requirements and thresholds where investigations are concerned with health boards. It does establish a 180-day investigation completion requirement, albeit with some opportunities, you know, for time extensions to be enacted. But, you know, that process creates more of an administrative burden and subtracts from the time that we should be spending, you know, to move investigations forward as efficiently as possible. The bill doesn't fund the investigator that we know that we desperately need to concentrate on behavior analyst investigations in particular. So, you know, that bill has been sort of, you know, it's been a concern. It also has some, there's some paragraphs where two sentences in the same paragraph can be construed to be contradictory. Specifically, boards can only investigate the allegations that are made or that are submitted. And so that might look something like, you know, inadequate, insufficient documentation, but the investigation really finds there's fraud behind it. So this could we open up the investigation to include what we found? Well, the second sentence in the paragraph says we can, but the first sentence in the paragraph really says we can't. So I can't reconcile what I see as contradictions in the same paragraph in my mind. I also see some language that provides for opportunity for closed evidentiary hearings. I wonder if that is a open meeting law violation. So, you know, that's something that that I've kind of flagged. So my colleagues have found, you know, other issues with the language. And so there's a lot of conversations happening about that bill. Curiously, it was scheduled for the final reading in the Senate very early this week, maybe on Monday. But the it actually didn't, it wasn't heard. So I don't know if it was held. I can't find any entries. I really don't know the status of House Bill 2686. I check obsessively, but I don't have any clarity today, better clarity than, you know, I did on Monday. So most of the other bills, you know, just sort of have, they've either died or, you know, the impact is really so minimal. It's just sort of an FYI, you know, things like, we're not concerned about opening up, or engaging in a sunrise hearing for purposes of considering a expansion of scope of practice. That's a professions issue. So that is a bill that was signed by the governor recently, which allows a profession just to introduce legislation and not have to go through the sunrise process. So that's interesting, but it really doesn't have any bearing on this board or, you know, its regulatory responsibilities. So any questions about anything that you've read in the report or you've heard me say, but that's really all I have today. And I promise you, future reports will be extremely brief and succinct because, again, you know, the final bills that have the potential to reach the finish line are for the most part there or not there.
You know, Ms. Pakkanen, I really like your very detailed analysis of the bills. I read your reports with, you know, much interest because I mean, you know, it's fascinating the kinds of things that go through and kinds of things that don't go through. I mean, sometimes there is method to madness, sometimes there isn't, but I appreciate your attention to detail and keeping us apprised of all of the developments.
You're very welcome.
Seeing no questions from Ms. Pakkanen, let's go to number 13 on our agenda. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding report on the March 7, 2024 Behavior Analyst Regulators meeting. And on this, Dr. David, do you want to lead our discussion?
Yeah, I just want to take a few moments to allow the board to understand the position of which Arizona is in. And this board has helped propel the state of Arizona to the forefront when it comes to behavior analysts and regulation. And so we had the opportunity to attend the regulators meeting as part of a national conference for the Association of Professional Behavior Analysts. And at that meeting, there were multiple jurisdictions, I would say probably close to 30, 35 different jurisdictions represented from across the country, including some friends from up north in Canada. It was a mix of regulators and clinicians that help provide regulation nationally across various boards. And was hosted by the national certifying body, the BACB, and just Arizona's practices, Arizona's innovations were referenced several times. In fact, Ms. Pakkanen and I were invited up to the lectern to answer questions as they were fired to us by the Director of Regulatory Affairs for the BACB and how Arizona handles and addresses things. We were also allowed to share some of our innovations, the RAMP program, the JET program that we built out for the psychologists and hope to bring on for the licensed behavior analyst soon. And it was just a great opportunity to really collaborate and share and highlight the strides that this board and the Committee on Behavior Analysts have made on a national front. And I would just take this moment, Mr. Diner, to thank Ms. Pakkanen and Ms. Michelson, who traveled to be there as representatives of the regulator representatives of the board. Ms. Denton was there, our current chair for the CBA, past board member, Dr. Davis Wilson was at our table. Am I missing anybody else that was there? Ms. Pakkanen from Arizona? Arizona was well represented. We had our own table and fought people for the free desserts. So we won on all accounts.
Now I'm having FOMO.
You should. We'll drag you with us next time.
Great work, Dr. David. Thank you for your report. And thank you, everybody, for, you know, that you mentioned for participating in this and, you know, learning from other similarly situated parties and contributing your insights as to Arizona practice to them. Any questions for Dr. David? Hearing none, I think I'm just going serial and then we'll jump back. 15 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to change terminology on pre-internship verification form. And Dr. Flynn, do you want to lead us with this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to acknowledge the very odd gremlins that got to the email that you all saw. I swear to you, that's not what it looked like when it came off my computer. I can actually speak in full words, so I'm not sure what happened there. I apologize. The gist of this is, and as a new member of ARC, I started seeing my name in a line on this form, pre-internship site section B. Normally the director of clinical training at institutions will fill out this form or their designee that says name of faculty supervisor right under the description of training. And then under that name of primary supervisor, of course, is at the site, at their clinical training off-site. When I'm listed as the name of faculty supervisor, the use of the word supervisor is problematic. I have zero control over what happens at a site, zero oversight. I'm a seminar leader. We talk about professionalism issues. And so I'm really concerned that that's being filled out in a way that would imply that the faculty member has anything to do with the site other than just talking about issues and helping students problem solve. Unless this line is needed for some other sort of, checks and balances for the regulation or rules, statutes, I would like to see it taken off altogether, or at least that supervisor word changed to something that would be more appropriate. Dr. Seidman, I see that you have input.
Yes. So I hope people were not distracted by those gremlins that Dr. Flint included in her email.
I didn't type it that way, I swear.
Uh-huh. Needless to say, I totally support Dr. Flint's suggestion. In fact, if it's possible, I would just remove that line because really the director of clinical training is the ultimate verifier of the pre-doctoral internship experience. And there really is no faculty supervisor. There's an advisor, like an academic advisor, and a practicum seminar instructor. So I totally support that. Thank you, Dr. Flint, for finding that, catching that, and bringing that up.
Dr. Carino?
I think that sometimes we need a faculty contact if the internship supervisors have passed on or we can't locate them. So I thought we could say, I like the idea of saying that university director of clinical training or something, program director of clinical training.
Yeah.
So we have that contact. But I agree, the supervisor gives the wrong impression.
So then Dr. Flynn's suggestion is to delete that. And Dr. Caterino, are you saying we maybe change the name of faculty supervisor to something else?
Yeah, that was her second choice. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, so as a program, clinical training director of graduate program.
Is there not a director of clinical training on that form already?
Look at it.
It's signed by that person immediately below, verified to be completed by DCT. It can be a faculty supervisor or other institutional official. So 9 times out of 10, it seems like it is the DCT. However, there is a caveat for some other people.
Could be a program chair as well. Mm-hmm. So a verification by faculty, perhaps.
But I think every program has a clinical training.
So what I'm hearing is the information about whom to contact with at the university is reported on the form in just a different place. We don't need to create the impression that the faculty supervisor is also sort of a supervisor in sort of a clinical setting at the site. So we want to sort of dispel any notions about that. And then I guess the next question is, do we also need to address the same term faculty supervisor in that section C? Does that affect anything, Dr. Flint or Dr. Seidman?
There aren't any faculty supervisors in the true supervision responsibility for patient. So I would agree to make, if we take it out up above, If it can be any faculty that would sign this in lieu of the DCT, then just leave it as faculty.
You don't think putting clinical training director would be good?
It says that first. So it's to be completed by DCT, faculty supervisor, or other institution official.
But it doesn't say directly it has to be the clinical training director.
Dr. Seidman?
Yeah, I believe the rationale is just to that the internship is connected to the academic institution and that they have communication and it's a seamless relationship. So it just has to be an academic representative that needs to sign that document, be it a director of clinical training, which like Dr. Catarino said, all programs have a DCT. And if that person's on vacation or they never get on vacation, by the way, they're not allowed vacations. But if they do happen to have that vacation, then the chairperson could sign that because the chair is always available. So some faculty representative.
You could say director of clinical training or other academic official.
Yeah, that's a great idea, Dr. Catarino.
So Dr. Catarino, to just clarify, we'd remove the name of faculty supervisor up above, change the section C designation to be faculty representative. Is that accurate? Well,
no, what I was suggesting is leave where it says primary supervisor, above that put university program director of clinical training / other academic official, and then name a primary supervisor. And just go on, just insert that in the line where it says faculty supervisor.
But wouldn't we have that under section C?
That section C just says university. That's E. One of them just says university.
Well, section C is verified by, right?
And yeah, but it could be the dean, could be anybody. It doesn't have to be the clinical, because the clinical training person, sometimes they have internship classes, you know, so they are more in contact, I thought. But the other one doesn't say clinical training director. That's all. No word doesn't say that.
Mr. Chair, board members, this is Kathy, if I may.
Yes.
As Dr. Catarino noted, 9 times out of 10, these are signed by the director of clinical training. However, the only time that I have seen where it is not signed by the director of clinical training is when the program has been closed and the site supervisor has had to complete this, such as the Argosy student or applicants from Argosy. I don't know if that helps any, but I wanted to provide that insight.
Just a question. Go ahead, Dr. Flynn.
Dr. Catarino, is your concern that the person verifying what is written above might not be the same person who wrote it above? So that first line should say director of clinical training?
I wanted that on B, yes. Okay. I just thought they would be more familiar with the actual site, the number of hours, all those things, where the other could just be, you know, somebody that is more removed from the actual internship training experience. The faculty could be anybody.
Okay, so my question for maybe Ms. Folks was, in the Argosy situation, then does the section C language of other institution official capture that? Because so subsection B is to be completed by the applicant and verified by the educational institution, but then we don't have Argosy because it doesn't exist. So then subsection C is verified by, and then that's like somebody from the educational institution, right? So I see Dr. Seidman's hand up. Maybe he has the answer.
Yeah, having unfortunately witnessed that directly, the Argosy closure, there was nobody available to be a signator for those forms. So Ms. Fowkes, how was that handled? By the way, that's a rarity.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Dr. Seidman, board members, this was handled by having the site supervisors complete Section C of that form, because as you said, there were no officials from Argosy to sign it. So we had, the board had accepted the site supervisor instead. My other question to the board, relative to Dr. Caterino's suggestion of having that line be the director of clinical training, is the board seeking the name of the director of clinical training that is current to the time that the verification is being signed, or to who the director of clinical training was, say, 10 years ago? When
I think it could be either one if that person is not available. And yeah. They could always write, if the school closed, or in my case, the program closed, they could just say NA. But students have come to me, even though our program is closed, and I signed the form. So you could always just say, not applicable, program closed.
Yeah, and current programs always have a DCT who has a paper trail of their training experience that are connected with the internship site. So somebody would be available. I think it's just a representative who could vouch for that information.
I want to see what I want is that it's an internship that's approved by a university training program, not just they picked up, they're working for somebody on the side and they say, yeah, I'm the supervisor. I wanted it to be like we say, a part of an approved program. That's why Amen. I wanted that.
I agree.
So then Section D also says faculty supervisor at the top. Is that affected as well?
There are no faculty supervisors. So I would assume everywhere a supervisor again implies that I have clinical responsibility for that patient. And that's not how any of the programs are set up. So anywhere that appears.
And right there, it says institutional official, which could be what we were talking about earlier. We could just use institutional official.
So Ms. Pakkanen or Ms. Galvin, is that enough of direction to staff, or do you need a motion or consensus or however you want to proceed?
I would be fine with a consensus, and I'll leave it up to staff if they believe they have enough direction.
I'm clear, Mr. Chair, Ms. Folks. She edits credit to Kathy. She does a great job of editing, documents. And this, we haven't done this in a while, but it's not terribly unusual for, us to do this. And we do have latitude in the rule that, we can make what are really non-substantive changes as long as they don't conflict with, the statutes or rules. And this is more of a, an editorial kind of edit. And so I don't see any concerns with us, implementing this moving forward, with the understanding we're going to continue to see, of course, active applications where, the document still reflects what we would prefer it not. But then, over time, we'll see the new version in use. And we can also, of course, ensure that as new applicants are starting the process, right away, they have access to an edited, updated form.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. And Dr. Flynn, thank you for bringing this issue. I mean, I know it might be viewed as a small thing, but it isn't. I mean, that it can cause, problems down the line and things snowball, and, you prevented that from happening. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I think then we move back up to number 9, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning unlicensed board certified behavior analysts employed in Arizona schools. And let me pull it up. And on this, Ms. Pakkanen will provide us a summary.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I do think that, Dr. Stenhoff and Dr. Davey, that their insights are especially valuable here as well.
So what this agenda item does is it calls, I think, attention, you know, shines a spotlight on what has been a known issue, probably more so in the behavior analyst sort of, you know, realm that it has, you know, in the broader sense for the psychology board. But there is language in 32.2091.08 at A1 that establishes essentially a non-existent exemption to licensure. It is, I describe it sometimes as a copy and paste sort of error, if you will, from the psychology statutes, where essentially, you know, the genesis of the Behavior Analytic Practice Act borrowed heavily from the psychologist language. And so this exemption was crafted based on probably, you know, some reasonable assumptions, but we've come to find out that there really is no basis for this. What this means is that this licensure exemption assumes that the Arizona Department of Education is certifying BCBAs to function as such in the schools. And that was not a well-informed policy decision. We have confirmed that the department doesn't even have the statutory authority to grant this kind of certification. So this doesn't necessarily mean that this is a hugely widespread problem. There is some, you know, acknowledgement that BCBAs, you know, if they carry some other sort of certification, like, you know, as a special education teacher, that may remedy the issue. But, you know, to sort of the strict interpretation about this mirage, if you will, of a licensure exemption, it really isn't a thing. And we can't sort of consider, we can't know for sure that schools or school districts are using sort of a proxy approach, if you will, by verifying the certification of these BCBAs and determining that's good enough. We assume that when someone is being evaluated, their qualifications are being evaluated for licensure, that, you know, there's some due diligence associated with, you know, verifying their BACB certification, but that's not a substitute. So anyway, again, this awareness has been here. It's starting to become more of an issue as there's more questions and conversations around, am I exempted? How does this exemption pertain to me, or does it? Should I apply? So those kinds of questions are starting to swirl around more earnestly. And so what the committee did recently, their meeting last week, is they began discussing this, and with the possible outcome that, you know, a recommendation would be made to this board in terms of, you know, here's a strategy moving forward. Here's how we manage the situation in the absence of, you know, revising the statute right here, right now, which we cannot do. So we don't have a recommendation from the committee at this time. What the committee elected to do was, you know, gather more facts, gather more information, invite the key stakeholders into the discussion very soon. And so what comes to the board is a very comprehensive, well-rounded recommendation. What I think that we also need to do is put the governor's office, put this in front of the governor's office just for purposes of awareness to say, you know, we've sort of realized this is not so much of an abstract issue. It's more than that. We're working on a solution. We would love, you know, some direction, of course, but we fully intend, you know, to come back with what we hope is an appropriate solution, you know, that's widely informed by all the perspectives that need to be included. So again, no specific recommendation, but this board needs to be aware of this issue, and hopefully, you know, have some confidence in the committee's ability to do its work, to do the labor involved, if you will, and then bring to the board, you know, something for the board to consider. So happy to answer any questions, but you know, Dr. Davey looks really like he's poised to jump into this as well.
Yeah, Dr. Davey or Dr. Stenhoff, if you have any things to share.
Mr. Chair, I actually defer to Dr. Stenhoff. I know he was pretty passionate about this at the CBA level.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, this is, as Ms. Pakanon alluded to, this has been a problem that's been looming, I guess is a good way to say it, and not to blow up, but I think there's going to be some ramifications for it over time. As behavior analysts, the common phrase was, well, if you're working in a school, you don't need to be licensed. And so I don't have it quantified, but a good majority would be my guess of behavior analysts in the state are under the impression that if I am practicing in a school, I do not need to be licensed. And as Ms. Pakanon also mentioned, is that the rate at which people are applying or coming to the board that we're practicing in schools is increasing, not exponentially, but it's certainly increasing. And the awareness that you might need to get licensed is going to start happening. So yeah, there's going to need to be some direction to the public or to the behavior analysts in the state, and also working with the Arizona Department of Ed on what that might look like over time and how quickly. So it is a problem. It's out there. And unfortunately that phrasing got placed out there at the onset of our licensure, back in 2010, 2011. And so, and there's still a lot of people under that perception. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. Mr. Nguyen.
Yeah, just a question. This is like, I guess, just my ignorance on the issue. Heidi, you had mentioned that this is kind of a copy and paste over from the psychologist side of things. So, and again, like, excuse my ignorance on this, but psychologists don't have to be licensed if they work within the school. There's an exemption for that. Is that a thing?
Yeah, you can be a school psychologist and not be a licensed psychologist because you're certified.
Okay, and then follow-up question on that. What was, just trying to grasp this, not being in the profession, what was the reasoning for this exemption for psychologists, and how does that reasoning not translate to behavior analysts?
Historical. It's been this way, you know, it worked school psychologists from a long time before they required APA and states required licensure. I think it's just that they were there first, and they have programs that are geared for ed specialists and masters that they couldn't get licensed as psychologists. They're not doctoral at all. Some.
Okay. So it was like predate the whole licensing system generally. Yeah. And then when the whole behavior analyst thing came on, they said, oh, well, we'll just move this over. And now it's creating that. Okay. All right. I'm up to speed now. And just a general comment, real supportive of hearing more from, you know, the committee, the folks in the know about this and deciding how to take a path forward in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Ms. Pakanon.
Yes, just really quickly, I think to add to, you know, what Dr. Catarino was describing. So there are, Mr. Nguyen, a few boards, I don't even know how many, but some do, some psychology boards also regulate school psychologists. So again, you know, from a historical perspective, a policy decision was made decades ago that, you know, that would be divided. There are some a substantial number of individuals who hold both licensure through our board because they meet the qualifications to do so. You know, they had the, they acquired the education training, you know, testing and so forth. And then they're also additionally certified by the Department of Education. So you will see that dynamic for sure. But I think it would be accurate to say that, you know, historically, we've sort of stayed in the each it in our own lanes, so to speak. So, you know, the psychology board, you know, where individuals who are solely Department of Education certified to do what they do, you know, we haven't sort of interfered, you know, in that world and vice versa. So what this does, though, is it represents an opportunity. I see it as an opportunity for two very disparate agencies, you know, to come together and, you know, hopefully in the process solve a problem that's, you know, a little potentially, you know, overwhelming in a sense to think about. I mean, because we don't know what we don't know.
So for this, Ali, Mr. Wynn, I was just going to add, a school psychologist would want a license if they want to open their private practice. They want to do what they do outside of the school, right? But in the school, for example, you can be a school psychologist at the master's level. And so there are lots and lots of school psychologists, but how many of those can be licensed, then the number shrinks.
That's helpful.
Yeah, and I want to say it's sort of like a tough one because, yeah, I mean, I certainly like don't have any evolved understanding of this, you know, by any means. But I mean, I feel like I think the policy, I mean, I understand the copy paste, but with respect to the school psychologists, maybe, you know, the thing in people's minds is, well, you would rather want some sort of psychological services available in a school setting. So let's make it easier for people to be like master's level psychologists, like right in a school setting, and maybe that's why historically there is a preference for rather let's just rather have some services rather than no services. So I mean, given that notion, and you know, given all of the things that we know policy wise, you know, from what the governor has said publicly, from what you know the legislature thinks of is, in our schools and students, I mean, that's typically a big issue in many people's minds. And I just wonder, I'm just curious what the governor's office has to say about this too, because, you know, if they don't want to create the impression that we'll make, you know, all of these behavior analysts in a school setting get licensure within a short period of time, you know, maybe the policy weighing different considerations and factors might give a different answer than the answer that, you know, some of us are thinking of. So it's just, yeah, it's a tough issue. And, you know, I don't envy Dr. Stenhouse and, you know, all of the other efforts at the committee level that are going into solving this issue. Dr. Caterino.
Well, see, the difference is the school psychologists do have a certification where there is no certification. So, I mean, really, maybe if they want this, then they need to lobby the Department of Education. Sometimes I've gone down to and worked on a law there. They could get a certification implemented, but they don't have it. So I think they should have some regulation, either licensure now, because that's all that's available.
Dr. Davey?
Yeah, I'll just comment on that. Like, we have no intention of asking for a new certification to be created at the school level. The licensure mechanism is just fine for the public and should be extended through the Department of Education's purview in terms of educational environments. I think we're just cleaning up a relic from the past. Mm-hmm. It's been identified previously. We just have not had the bandwidth and the fortitude to take it on. And now we're to the point to do that. We've got you know, staff support and know that it's going to be a lift to clean it up. But it's definitely something that has been a long time coming. And I think this will ultimately provide clarity not only to licensees, but to nationally certified behavior analysts and to the public as to what the expectation and the standard of care is in the state of Arizona.
Ms. Pakkinen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And more on that theme, Dr. Davey, it's almost like we were coordinating our messages a little bit, but the House Bill 2068, which, you know, we knew that, we recognize it to have been the bill that would have established the independent Behavior Analyst Board, it did propose striking out this exemption entirely. So the demise of that bill, you know, left us, it just, you know, eliminated an opportunity for this problem to be resolved, you know, 5 months from now or whatever. So, you know, we know that we can't just sort of pretend that, you know, this is going away because, you know, that opportunity was denied. So, yeah, some sort of a comprehensive, you know, thoughtful path forward needs to be identified. And it's just going to take some work to get there.
So I sort of have like a procedural question. So at least like I can't recall any title violation cases that have come out of this particular statute, but is that one of the ways in which we can proceed in the sense of, you know, if a complaint comes to the board of a behavior analyst in a school setting and that behavior analyst says, well, my understanding of the statute is that I don't need to be licensed with the board, then do we then just, you know, treat that as a regular complaint, maybe establish a precedent that way and say, you know, there is no certification from the Department of Education. Unfortunately, you needed to be licensed. It's a title violation. So go down that path, or are we thinking of maybe the behavior analyst committee coming up with some proposed language for a substantive policy statement saying, yeah, well, there's no Department of Education certification, unfortunately, for BAs. So we are construing this statute as requiring certification, meaning licensure as a behavior analyst in the state of Arizona. I'm just thinking aloud, you know, substantive policy statement or case by case. It's a tough policy position to be in because, I mean, you know, I know governor's office will have views on it, BSEB, BCB, a lot of stakeholders will have views on that. Ms. Gavin, I think I saw Dr. Stenhouse hand up, but.
No, Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Sorry. Ms. Gavin.
I think that question will ultimately come back to the board once there are some recommendations from the committee. I think that the information we have so far is that it's a systemic misunderstanding and misapplication of the statute, and perhaps getting guidance from the governor's office will help. But one option would be to give that affected population a certain number of days, weeks, to get in an application for licensure and allow the staff to process those, so you don't have a potentially hundreds of behavior analysts being disciplined or issued letters of concern or have complaints opened against them for what appears to be a misunderstanding and misapplication of the statute, and in turn have perhaps thousands of school-aged children not receive services. So I think it is a policy issue that the board is ultimately going to have to decide once the committee gets a little bit more information and is able to make a recommendation.
Mr. Nguyen?
Okay, on that point, Ms. Galvin, I guess, and again, I'm just trying to grasp this. There are currently behavior analysts that are working in schools that aren't licensed because they believe this exemption exempts them from it, but the Department of Education isn't doing anything to certify them. So they're kind of in this weird, like gray area kind of thing. And there's potentially hundreds of them that are doing that right now. Potentially. I mean, the number. Yeah,
we don't know for sure, but an educated guess from Dr. Stenhoff was be, you know, perhaps 100. But we're not holding them to that.
Interesting. Okay. But yeah, that complicates things a little bit.
Yeah, Mini, I mean, you know, I'm go ahead, sorry.
Mini could be board certified by the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, you know, but not licensed here.
Yeah,
Dr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I just think I would make that point to those listening and understanding that that is true, that that the individual that might be practicing in a public school, while they may not be licensed by this board and under the purview of the board currently, they do hold a national certification. They have, which is the gateway to licensure in the state of Arizona. So they've already hit their educational practices. They're bound by a national code of ethics, which we lean on as a committee on behavior analysts and often make recommendations to adjudicate matters. So there is a national certification attached to them. And again, we're not going to advocate our role as a state board, but in the interim, that has and will continue to serve as a buffer to protect the public.
And potentially, if we get a complaint, I mean, we can refer it to the national board for whatever action they deem appropriate, because, you know, they are licensed professionals, just not within the jurisdiction of this board. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you. And so let me try to get clear on this too. So national certification allows somebody to practice independently, not under supervision. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
In the counseling field, being an NCC, a national certified counselor, does not, it's different.
And I would just point out to you the without going into a full-blown history lesson, that, you know, it's been 15 to 20 years where we went through national certification and then states began to regulate, Arizona being one of the very early states to regulate and have licensure. In fact, we're only at 37 states today that actually have licensing boards that are charged with overseeing behavior analysts. So the national certifying body still holds kind of the final authority in 13 states plus some jurisdictions. And so we are still kind of adolescent in terms of the field. I won't call us a toddler still, but we're definitely not mature yet to have kind of those kinds of things in place. We're still upping our requirements for how many clinical hours you need to be able to sit for the exams. I mean, when we first started, 500, 750, you know, 1,000 were acceptable. This board was, you know, this board in its mindset was only around 1,500 had to be the minimum. Now we're nationally up to 2,000 as we're building a robust pipeline of professionals and clinicians to be able to serve across the United States. So we have a ways to go.
Mr. Wynn?
Yeah, I guess the next step, I guess, is what we're talking about, is this is going to go back to the committee on this. They're going to do, I guess, more research and such, and then come back with a recommendation, I think, is where I guess the talk is about this. In that process, is the body doing this work, are they going to be looking into exactly how many of these behavior analysts are currently working in schools and trying to get like an hour? Because I guess I have a couple concerns of just, you know, how you get that information out to folks that, you know, that, hey, all of a sudden what you were doing before is just, it's not going to work anymore. And what kind of disruption that causes in schools and the work that they're doing in schools. So I don't know. I'm just kind of putting that out there.
Ms. Paikkanen?
Yeah, Mr. Wynn, I think you're raising all the important questions and issues entirely. So we don't know. We don't have a way to quantify here now and today. But what we can do is, you know, as soon as we send the email blast out to all the BCBAs, which we would partner with the BACB to do. So, you know, everyone who is certified by that organization would then, you know, receive this communication that would include this subset, unknown, you know, quantity of a subset of BCBAs who aren't licensed by this board. So that's how we'll raise the awareness. And so it needs to be a very well done message that reaches them, right? But I think, you know, what you were describing in terms of, you know, let's have the subject matter experts at the committee level and, you know, inclusive of stakeholders, let's discuss this. I think that concurrently,
me reaching out to the governor's office and getting some sort of advice and direction to, you know, I don't want the governor's office to be the last to know, right? So they may have very specific direction that they want me to bring to you. And so, you know, in May, I may be telling you, this is what, you know, the governor's office needs this board to know and to do. So it may be that the committee's doing, you know, its work, but in the meantime, you know, the governor's office, recognizing and acknowledging how disruptive this may be, maybe they come in with, you know, a specific strategy that is really intended to minimize or ameliorate that disruption that we know could happen.
Mr. Chair, I would also add that another stakeholder will lean heavily on, besides the BACB, which was the obvious one, is also our state association. So AZABA has a robust presence here in the state, but also help us craft out some of the language, and has been a good partner in making sure that we're reaching those we need to reach.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Davey.
Mr. Chair, in addition to that, because of the employment status of those BCBAs, my assumption is we should also reach out to the ADE and also the local school districts as well to get that out, that information as well.
Very good. Does board staff and everybody have enough of an understanding of this issue? Is there a need for a motion? I don't think so, but you know, keep our ears to the ground and see what comes up. All right. Then the next item is 11, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding compliance with directive issued by Governor Katie Hobbs concerning healthcare licensing board's transparency and accountability. Ms. Pakkinen, would you want to give us a summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So we are to produce two deliverables by July 1. And so I'm pretty confident that we can definitely do one of the two today. And then we can get really close to producing the second one. And maybe we'll arrive there. Ultimately, you would have another opportunity, I guess, to finalize anything with your May agenda. But I plowed ahead, you know, with the hope that we would get much of this done, and maybe all of it today. So I actually encourage the board to scroll down through your file. Your file's a little messy. In my, I had, you know, my moment of triumph that I got this done on time. There are some errors in the file, so I'll explain those. But if you scroll all the way down to page 36 and it spills over just slightly onto page 37, this is the second of the two deliverables. This is a draft policy that I prepared, which I believe meets the requirements that Governor Hobbs had indicated, that outlines this board's, what actions this board will take when, you know, reviewing matters that may necessitate, or, you know, it may be in the public's best interest to refer matters elsewhere. You know, I think that this board, my observations is that the board sort of does this without prompt or intuitively, or, you know, that sense. But I think sort of articulating this in writing, obviously that's what the governor wants. It is a best practice. So the way I approach this part of the assignment, the second piece, is to craft something that is all inclusive of when we might want to forward a matter to elsewhere. So it could be law enforcement. It could be a protective agency. It could be the BACB. You know, it could be any number of organizations. So to me, this really codifies or formalizes what the board's practices are anyway. So I think, you don't have to tell me the document is perfect. You can tell me it's close to perfect, or, you know, tell me what to fix. But I think we can get this one adopted and approved quickly, and then, you know, focus on the more daunting, if you will, of, you know, the other task. So hopefully you've had a chance to read it and you have some thoughts or reactions to it.
Thank you, Ms. Packinen. And I looked at the policy and I'll reserve my thoughts, but any thoughts from any of the board members? Dr. Caterino?
Given the case we have this morning, like somebody in the pipeline, because that person it was not using the title of psychologist, but they were on license. Maybe somebody, I don't know how to say, applying for board approval, would it refer to them too?
So Dr. Caterina, that may be covered in the policy, that first paragraph policy. When reviewing all investigations of which a psychologist, a behavior analyst, or an unlicensed person unlawfully uses either title, I hope that that's clear. But what I tried to be was, to envision all the possibilities. So hopefully that captures what it is that you're thinking about.
Well, I thought I saw that, but that she wasn't using the title, I mean, somebody that's just applying.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I can definitely edit this to be inclusive of, someone applying. Absolutely. I see what you're saying. That could be better articulated.
And then the other question I had, Ms. Packinen, was, so the initial review happens in front of the full board, but do we want to also sort of be cognizant of this issue at the complaint screening committee stage or in the behavior analyst committee stage when we're evaluating complaints? I mean, just a thought. I mean, I guess the spirit of the governor's question or, sort of the urging of the governor's office is to make that sort of consciously think about that at all the sort of major stages that a case goes through. And seems to me that screening committee stage would be one more stage where we could potentially look at this.
I agree. Oh, does under procedures, does 1.3 get there?
Yeah, and it would appear.
Okay.
But then on the top 1.0, it's every investigation's initial review, the board shall exercise.
Yes. That needs to be modified for sure. Yeah. Okay, got it. Thank you.
I don't have any other thoughts. It was close to perfect, as Ms. Packinen said. Mr. Nguyen.
Are we just currently talking about the one on page 36? We're not discussing the options for like the first part, like the first page and the options up at the top. We're just talking about page 36 right now.
36 and 37, right, which is the item 2 of 2. Don't worry, we'll dive into all of the other stuff here shortly.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
I know you're eager, so.
I have opinions.
I hope you do.
Ms. Gavin?
Thanks. I was just wondering about under the procedures 1.1, and it says included in the deliberation phase of every investigation's initial review. Are we limited by saying an initial review? Because that's a very specific phase. It may not come to our attention until we do an investigative hearing or an informal interview. So maybe just included in every deliberation phase of every investigation. And not limit it to the initial review.
Yes. Good catch.
Anything else on this document? Ms. Packinen, do you feel like you have enough direction?
I do, Mr. Chair. I can definitely bring this back just, for one more look with the May meeting, particularly if we need one more meeting to wrap this up and, complete the, what we need to do in terms of the first deliverable. And the first deliverable is that rubric or matrix for disciplinary action and arriving at consistent decisions.
So here's what I did. I presented, you know, three very different options, but in doing so, what I felt was necessary, and this was confirmed with actually an extremely productive and, you know, supportive conversation that several of the EDs had with the governor's staff. Oh, should I pause there? Are there other questions before I dive into the next topic?
I can wait.
Yeah, Dr. Katrina said she'll wait, so we can go ahead, Ms. Packman.
Okay, so the governor's staff wanted the boards to know that the governor wants the boards to have support of the office. There's acknowledgement we are resource deprived, and so, you know, they want to shift their attention, and the awareness is there that, you know, we need more resources to be, you know, to be effective. So, you know, that's a long-term strategy, but in the short term, you know, they really want boards to, you know, take to heart exactly what was in the directive. And what really my primary question was, and I did receive, I think, the answer that I was kind of looking for, which is, you know, with respect to, you know, so we develop a tool or an instrument, and, you know, how do we do the audit piece? And, you know, the audit, the vision of the governor's office is not necessarily, you know, this formal external audit, you know, for which we pay thousands of dollars, you know, and we bring in that resource, or we, you know, sort of expect the auditor general's office to do that. But a self audit, even a peer audit, would be acceptable. And so my question was, if there's a scoring element to it, does that not sort of make the auditing process, you know, pretty easy? And there was a consensus and agreement that yes, and in point of fact, you know, that would render that the audit requirement to be, you know, a fairly straightforward exercise. So it could be done by a board member and staff, you know, presented to the board and so forth. So we do have some latitude around that. And so that's why you're seeing the tools that you're seeing, the proposed options. And I didn't want to overwhelm you necessarily, but, you know, I sort of landed on three different options. And so I'll characterize those a little bit. And it would not hurt my feelings if you say, you know, that any one of these is a non-starter. If you want to eliminate it and just trash it, that's fine. You know, I see the merits in potential merits in all of them. And I see, you know, the potential that we try one for a while. And if it doesn't work for whatever reason, you know, the governor's office said, absolutely, you know, you can pivot, you know, and you can make changes. So know that. So the first one, I think you'll recognize. So it really is representative of, work that the board has captured historically. It's prettier, and not because I did it. It's prettier because our student intern really cleaned up it was so old and so messy of a document. I couldn't even find the original source, the Word version or whatever the word processing program version was. So that starts on page 3. So it is the existing rubric. What it does, though, it introduces that the ability to, you know, look within a color band, look within a range, and make based on mitigating and aggregating factors, decide, you know, where does this fall on the scale? You know, we've looked at a multitude of factors, and yes, there was there is a violation, there was harm, but, you know, maybe it's mitigated by the fact that the licensee sort of, you know, recognized it at some point in the process and has demonstrated they're starting to make corrective action or whatever that, you know, that may be. You know, but if the aggregating factor shifts the situation into more of an intensive kind of outcome, then so be it. So really this tool on page 3 the green and the blue band, we're not talking about disciplinary action because, you know, that it's dismissal, it's, you know, non-disciplinary, you know, addressing it, the conduct through a letter of concern or a non-disciplinary CE order. It's really when you get to, you know, those other levels, levels 2, 3, 4, where the color intensity sort of, you know, where that increases, that you see that opportunity to apply the aggravating or mitigating scores. I borrowed those factors from a variety of sources. So I sourced them from a couple of other psychology boards, the Arizona Dental Board, and then proposed sort of, you know, a scoring rubric, if you will, that you could apply. So this is how I approach this exercise of trying to retrofit. You know, I heard the board say, well, you know, let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's work with, you know, some historical content. But this is where I landed to help us, you know, score, rank, and audit. So I'll pause there.
Mr. Nguyen?
I think first, I'm pretty sure that I'm right about this, but as you're scrolling down past like that first cover page, it should say option one, right?
It should. Yes.
Okay.
Wrong header. Okay.
No, I was like, am I confused here? Okay. Yeah. I'll just give like, I guess, initial reaction, I suppose, to start the conversation. First of all, this is like really helpful as a person, again, not in the field, just seeing for option one, just kind of the flow of like, oh, really helpful. Not that I haven't been doing it for a couple of years now on the board, but like still to be able to see kind of the flow chart of it. I think when I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about a couple things, how confusing the process can be, and hopefully it's not confusing. So it's a clear process for all of you, but also for folks like members of the public on the board, to make sure it's not like just like overwhelming, that it's objective in its conclusion of decision making. And I guess this relates to the other one, kind of ease of use just generally. I think one and two look pretty good, and I lean more towards one and kind of how the scoring is. That's just kind of my general opinion.
Great.
Dr. Caterina?
No, I thought this was great. One of the things that keeps coming up is how did we handle this in the previous case? And, you know, eventually there may be not be people that have been on the board forever that know, you know, how it was. So I also thought a component might be keeping track of whatever system we adopt, keeping track of the cases that come up and what the offense was and what we did about it, you know, something like that. So we could keep track if this is, we're following this and how many we have in each category. I sort of like one better because it's a little more general and not as specific, gives a little more leeway maybe to the board, but that's fine. I just wanted the record keeping part maybe to be included.
Dr. Seidman?
Yeah, I had a few thoughts. I'm quite impressed with all of the options actually. And a lot of work has been put into this, so I greatly appreciate it. I have a few thoughts. So one is, I would always argue for kind of an evidence-based foundation to any tool that we choose. With that said, I like the idea of piloting whatever we use and then looking at it to see how effective and efficient the tool is and ease of use as well. And, you know, being an academic member, we could always recruit students to help the staff.
Ms. Pekkanen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Seidman, I'm so glad you said what you said because, you know, that's with respect to evidence-based. What I feel that, you know, I see so much potential and, you know, merit in our first tool, proposed tool. What I'm... I just don't see, though, that it has, that it's backed by any evidence. So that's something that, you know, I guess, you know, maybe we just need to acknowledge it and decide, you know, how much, how that weighs into consideration. When we talk about the next tool, it's very evidence-based and data-driven. It's not our data, though. It's from, you know, a different state. So it draws, what we're doing is we're making some extrapolations that, you know, I don't feel are necessarily wrong or bad or problematic. But, you know, that's one of the things that I loved about Virginia's tool. And obviously FSBPT's tool is also evidence-based. So, you know, that's something that I think this board, you know, needs to really think about. So, yeah.
Dr. Seidman?
If I may, I want to go back to, you know, the beauty of pilot studies are we get to try stuff. And even though the initial tool might not have been developed from an evidence base, we can establish that, if you will. I lean towards efficiency and effectiveness, you know, versus a laborious tool.
Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say, you know, in the spirit of what Dr. Seidman mentioned about pilot, maybe trying both and seeing are we reaching the same conclusions with both? Which one is easier, right? Simpler, faster. And, you know, if they reach sort of the same conclusion the majority of the time, a significant majority of the time, 95% of the time or something like that, I mean, then we probably could use either, but it also gives us the opportunity to try and flush out which one is really easier and simpler to use. That's my comment.
So Ms. Pekkanen, for as a matter of clarification, so on our PDF page, starting on page 3, that ends at page 5, or does it continue on page 6?
It's inclusive of page 6, yes.
Okay, so, includes page 6.
If you want me to apply color to it, just to sort of, you know, for purposes of some continuity, then it looks like the content all belongs together, yes.
Yeah.
I think I was just running out of inspiration maybe by the time I got to that page, but now I see the potential to sort of make it look, you know, homogenous.
Yeah. No, so my question was going to be, so the page 3 to page 6 mm-hmm. is the option 1 that you mentioned on page 1.
Correct.
And then page 8 through 10 is the option 2 that you mentioned on page 1.
Correct. And what I noticed, too, is that there are some ghost pages, we'll call them, for whatever reason, in the second tool. And I don't know why they were inserted. So at any rate, the second tool, which was so very inspired by Virginia's work. So that begins on page, it's 3 pages. So it's 8, 9, and 10.
Yeah.
And I'll talk about that when you're ready, but.
Yeah, and you can talk. I've thoughts as to between 1 and 2, you know, I have thoughts on that, but I don't have thoughts on 3 yet. So maybe I want to talk about that. But I see Dr. Medina's hand is up, and then Dr. Stewart, and then Ms. Gaffin.
Sorry, it had stayed up. I don't have any other comments.
Okay. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pekkanen, looking on page 6, may I have you read that for me? It looks like on page 6, under scoring application, the total aggravating factor score, both of those are the same. So if it's high aggravating is the same as low score. Is that correct? Am I reading that correct?
Okay, Dr. Stewart, you're going to catch me. And, you know, I spent hours of my life reading this. And let's see if I if my brain still can make sense of it.
I may just be reading it incorrectly.
So if there's a high score, then right. that would steer in the aggravating factors category, right?
Correct.
So that would steer you toward, you know, a higher degree of discipline, something in the higher range.
Okay.
Because there were aggregating factors. So if it's low, though, then you would, so needs a less punitive. Sorry, that's a typo. So okay. I think you, yeah,
okay.
Yes. Right. I think my brain was reading this the wrong way, but that's definitely an edit. It needs to say a low rating justifies a less punitive okay. and a restrictive type of sanction. Thank okay. you for catching that.
Thank you. Sorry for yes. the interruption.
Okay.
Ms. Gavin? You're muted.
Sorry, with respect to that page 6, aggravating and mitigating factors, is this intended to be like a score sheet that a board member would complete, or is this just for reference?
So that's a great question, and it's one that I'm still sort of mulling over, and it may, you know, sort of be one that we need to be prepared to really tackle, you know, with the second part of this, you know, the second time that the board sees this material. What I think, there's different possibilities, right? So the board members could be sort of, you know, working on this independently and, you know, come up with their own worksheet. And then as the proceeding evolves and, you know, they learn more and they gather more facts, you know, they can just sort of, you know, change it around and, you know, make modifications. I don't know that I have a vision yet for, you know, how do we compile all this? Is there, you know, how do we actually apply these score sheets? I haven't thought quite that far, and there's a whole lot of considerations to be made around, you know, is this part of the investigative record? And so it's confidential and, you know, those kinds of things. So my brain has not gone quite that far. I haven't been, I haven't had the time, you know, to really, I guess, fully develop my thinking to, I know where your brain is going.
So I do think that it would be worth staff's time and the board's time if we do make some kind of consideration for that and you make a recommendation to the board later. Any type of, you know, a scoring sheet that you would use, you know, during the deliberative process, there could be an argument that it's a public record. There is a long line of cases that decision makers and judges should not be required to disclose their decision-making process and mm-hmm. attest to their decision-making process. I wouldn't want, you know, score sheets to be out there that you then complete that then become public record that would subject you to a deposition to explain your decision-making process. So I think if we have guidelines about what to consider and you know, what constitutes, you know, a high mitigating factor or low aggravating factor, whatever it is, can serve as a guidance. But I don't want you to be put in a position where you're, you know, are sued and have to explain your vote.
Yeah, and every board is going to have to go through this exercise too by July 1 as well. So, you know, this may turn into a pretty broad discussion.
Yeah.
Dr. Medina?
Thank you. I was just going to point out on page 6, when we look at the total aggravating factor score, the total mitigating factor scores right below the ranges are not correct because the maximum score on that category would be 18. So they would need to be fixed. There are 10 items for aggravating factors and only 6 items for mitigating factors. So the ranges we would have to adjust. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good math skills.
Dr. Seidman?
I inadvertently raised my hand. I'm sorry. I was getting excited about these rubrics.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, in terms of selecting option one, option two, or option three, I want to give Ms. Packington a chance to explain option three. But my initial thought in looking at these materials and studying them was option three seems too complicated. So maybe I don't want us to spend more time than we need to. If that's like a non-starter, or if that there's a consensus, let's just discuss option one and two. So I just want to get people's reactions to that, and then we can proceed with discussing one and two. Mr. Nguyen.
I second your opinion of
and I see head nods. Ms. Packington.
Yes. So, you know, I've been, you know, quite transparent about my admiration for that tool. But the more time I spent looking at it and comparing it to others, the less enamored I was of it, quite honestly. So, you know, if you're worried about hurting my feelings, which this exercise is so not about that, but honestly, you know, I see plenty of justification for why, you know, like on House Hunters, where they eliminate, you know, one of the houses that they absolutely will not consider. If you want to take that action right here, right now, let's, you know, let's do that. And then we can focus on how do we make one or two, you know, the best possible tool.
Yeah. Seems like there's a consensus around discussing options one and two. So let's do that. And I've looked at the Virginia model, and again, just initial reactions. I want everyone's thoughts on this. And the option one, and I was just wondering, option one is option one for a reason. Maybe you had a reason to put that as option one. I'm maybe reading too much into it, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is the more it becomes a numbers game. I mean, I understand evidence-based, you know, I would want to think through the implications of sort of making this a mechanistic process where, as Ms. Galvin was mentioning, okay, this is a score of 105 and therefore this is a score of 84, therefore this. I mean, there's some judgment that is included in the way that the board deliberates and makes decisions. So, I mean, there are some judgment calls that don't lend themselves to just precise sort of, you know, numbering. So my initial reaction is, you know, the pages 3, 4, and 5 are pretty much what we have been doing as a board for a long time. I mean, we do consider all of these aggravating, mitigating factors. And then my question was, well, you know, is page 6 included in option one? And it is. And so, I mean, I'm fine with sort of having like this as a reference sheet, like just to sort of collect our thoughts when we're evaluating cases. But I, as Ms. Galvin was indicating, I don't want it to sort of turn into an exercise where, oh, this is a score of blah, and, you know, it's not a mechanistic thing like that. But I mean, as going to sort of Dr. Seidman's view of, you know, as a pilot, you know, we can try it out and see how it works. And if we need to tweak things, or if we need to, if we come to a realization that we are using the first three pages, but not the fourth page, you know, that will sort of, you know, inform our understanding as we use the tool a few times. The Virginia model, the second option, is I think more numbers based than option one, and based on sort of my just sort of gut reaction to, you know, this isn't a numbers game sort of thing. Between those two, I tend to prefer option one that we have. But again, just my initial reactions and my personal thoughts, I'm certainly, you know, open to your guys' thoughts on this as well. Dr. Davey.
Yeah, just one comment on the tools, and I guess the question would go to Ms. Galvin. You know, if we standardize those kinds of things, would they be discoverable or used during administrative hearings, or when things roll forward, could those then be used to look at, you know, the thought processes of individuals? That's a little bit different than like the notes I write down when I'm reading through it, if we standardize those processes. So I'd be interested on your take on that.
They very well could be requested, and we may be required to produce them either at an administrative hearing or on appeal. If there was an allegation that the board abused its discretion in rendering a decision, it's possible.
Yeah, now I'm on mute. has to happen to everybody at least once, and has happened three times to me. So what does that tell you about me anyway? Dr. Seidman, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. The option, the latter option doesn't include aggravating or mitigating factors. And so that looks too numbers driven and does not allow for mitigating and aggravating factors to be considered, I don't think. So I'm going to make a vote for the former. I'm not making a motion. I'm just making a statement. I prefer that one.
Understood. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. I think as we get into more psychometric push on this, that we're on a thin ice. The more we rely upon specific scores, cutoff scores, and how do we label that? We get into something that I'm not sure we're ready to defend. And what is the statistical analysis of this over time? We're just not there yet. I don't think, unless Virginia has done this over time and we have research to back that up and some kind of study of it, I just don't think we're there to. I think it's good as an informal scoring technique to conceptualize things. But if I'm just real hesitant, and I recommend caution as we get more and more into psychometric parts of this, I think we could fall through the thin ice. Thank you.
Dr. Katerina?
Yeah, I liked one better because it gives a little more judgment, and there are, everything can't just be reduced to numbers. Even though they have mitigating factors, it sometimes doesn't get at the heart of the issue. I also was thinking, now that we heard it could be asked for in court, that I might want to do two, for example, one when I read it and one after we've discussed it and I've heard another perspective, because I might change my mind or realize that somebody had a very good point. So I don't want to be held maybe to the first one in the court situation, because I might have changed my mind. That's it.
Ms. Paikkanen?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond quickly to Dr. Stewart. So Virginia looked at 4 years of data, and so they validated their tool against 4 years of data, inclusive of not only the psychology board, but their board of behavioral health, which I think might be, it's all the professions. It might be all under one big board, unlike here where it's separated. But to that point, that means that the data, was largely driven by the behavioral health professions, those actions and those outcomes. Psychology would have been, a small subset of, a much bigger set of data. So that's something for us to keep in mind. So we have no such study, we haven't had we would need, I'd love to do this study. I'd love to do it tomorrow, but we would need, the resources to do it. And maybe Dr. Seidman has students that are, ready and eager to take this on, but, we're not there, so.
Dr. Seidman?
Ms. Paikkanen, I think maybe Dr. Flint and I could corral some folks up if we needed to and if you're open to that. But it sounds like Governor Hobbs wants us to submit a deliverable. And it also sounds like there is some flexibility that we can try something and see how it works. So I don't know if we need to, you know, identify all the psychometric properties of the tools that we have and do a reliability study and do inter-rater reliability studies. But we would want to do something to look to see how effective that tool would be.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I certainly agree with Dr. Caterino that, you know, if it's discoverable in court and we fill out two forms on the same case before and then after deliberations, I think upon those of us that's been on the witness stand understanding very clearly that we can be eviscerated by the cross-examination process of were you sleeping during the meeting? Why'd you change it? What's this score versus that one? And it's not going to be pretty.
Dr. Medina?
I was going to suggest maybe the first step might be using this with previous cases. We have recordings. And how would we, you know, different people would rate each area, right? Instead of, you know, using it for future. And I know we have to submit something. But I also hear that there is some leeway to adjust as needed. And it may give us time if we, you know, set up X amount of time and let's review these cases. We already have the recordings. How are we maybe rating those cases that we already viewed the data there, there's not going to be a big implication in terms of, oh, we're using this with this new case. Just a thought.
I see Ms. Galvin's hand up and she'll probably say what I have on mind. So I think the trouble with that is it will be viewed as the board relitigating, reevaluating closed cases. And then, you know, the licensees would want to have a say in that. And so it's like reopening a case sort of thing. So I would stay a little bit away from that. But I mean, I understand that the goal is to sort of see if mapping this tool on what we have decided and see if, you know, whether it matches. I mean, I understand the concept, but it's just sort of, you know, what's allowed to the board by, you know, our statutes and whatnot.
When we do, I mean, we don't have to make public that we're using like the recordings are, right, are public domain.
I think it could become very obvious that even though we're using past cases for like a training exercise, I do believe, I mean, we could use them. And then if the decision is something different than what was actually rendered, you know, could be problematic. Maybe we can come up with vignettes for training instead of past cases.
Yeah. Vignettes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And the other thing with that is, you know, reasonable minds can still disagree on like the margins. So, I mean, that's why we have multiple members on the board. Not all of our decisions are unanimous. Some have, you know, some room for play in the joints. So I think, I mean, the structure of the board adequately allows for like pages 1, 2, and 3 of option one. And that's what we have been doing. The more I'm thinking about the scoring system, the more I have sort of questions of, you know, how to implement that, you know, what sort of future liability that we expose the board to when we have a scoring rubric. So anyway, I'm just thinking aloud, sorry. Dr. Flint.
I wonder if there's room on the current pages 1, 2, and 3 to narrow the columns just a little bit and have a preliminary score from our own review. And we should never be making a final decision until we hear the deliberation. And then we would have a final score category. That way it's on one form. It's clear that something that was presented that day influenced the change. Just a thought.
Dr. Caterina?
I like Dr. Flint's comment. Also, I was, I just forgot what I was going to say. I'll think of it again. Sorry.
We'll come back to you, you know, if you remember. So, Ms. Pakkanen, do you have enough guidance or do you need any specific? Oh, go ahead, Dr. Caterina.
I remembered. I'm so sorry. I was thinking what we could do is personally just keep track for ourselves with one of those forms, maybe option one, and just on our own, just, you know, when we meet again, you know, just think to ourselves, yeah, I like that, that worked for me and or not. And we don't have to show that to anyone, just be our own personal thoughts, so, you know, informally, just a thought.
So Ms. Pakkanen, do you have enough or do you need any specific thing from us? I mean, I think there is consensus, and please tell me if I'm wrong, on option one, and that there may be some sort of like minor nits. For purposes of giving this to the governor's office, there are minor nits, and then it will be deliverable in some shape. The only sort of question in my mind is, you know, once it becomes a deliverable, it becomes a public record. And I frankly don't know. I mean, I could go either ways on this. I frankly don't know if we would either end up using or if it would come to bite us in the future if we include the fourth page, just because, you know, it's yeah, we are creating sort of like a test, let's say, and, you know, the efficacy of that testing tool has not been, you know, we don't have means to gather data in the short, you know, margin that we have before June or July when we have to deliver. So I guess my question is, does it make sense to say, okay, you know, first three pages are pretty much in a good shape. That's what the board has been doing at each stage. We have been looking at these aggravating mitigating factors, and that's enough of a rubric in terms of deliverables to the governor, and it's enough of a rubric that gives that it can be used as a reference point. It's like one document that gets added to our Google folder when we are evaluating all of the case documents for a meeting. And we'll certainly, you know, look at that and consider it, but we aren't really like scoring anything. It's just a reference point that is a tool available to us if you want to get our thinking, wrap our thinking around the facts that we see in a case. How about that? Again, I'm stress testing something that I'm thinking aloud. Ms. Pakkanen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think you're articulating exactly what is, you know, where I've arrived at in my thinking. So my plan is to take, again, that policy for referrals. So you made some great content suggestions, some edits that I think are important. So I'll make those and bring those back in May. Additionally, what I will bring back in May is only tool number one. And I will remove the scoring elements of page, what is it, six. I will apply color because we've all agreed that that's important. But once I take away the scoring piece, this is more of a set of factors that board members can consider and evaluate and will have some bearing on where you decide to land within any particular band. So I still think that that's auditable. But we can try it and, you know, see, you know, how that audit exercise works. And, you know, again, if it's proven to be, you know, too much of a struggle, we will revisit it. So there will be also a narrative that describes how the board is to use, you know, this rubric. But I'm hearing you loud and clear that the scoring piece really is, it's taking us in a potentially dangerous direction. That being said, I'm also hearing you say there is great value in these aggravating and mitigating factors, just sort of, you know, having them in front of you to contemplate and in your own mind to calculate into, is this a decree of censure or is that going to take care of the, you know, remedy the issue and protect the public, or is more intensive, you know, corrective action with oversight, is that necessary? So those factors will play a role in, you know, how every board member evaluates the facts and circumstances in front of you, but not to apply, you know, a score that, you know, could become problematic for all the reasons we've talked about.
Dr. Seidman?
Yeah, thank you. So Ms. Pakkinen, that sounds great. You'll include the top part of page six, so you'll have those, the list of aggravating and mitigating factors included. That's wonderful.
Yes, yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. I absolutely love that idea, Heidi. I think we're on target. And there's nothing that says we have to derive at individual scoring before and after considerations. We can just, like what we have done, most of the time we're pretty close together. Many of our decisions are unanimous. And so my suggestion is, at least if it doesn't violate the rules of the governor's office, that we look at filling one of these sheets out per case at the end of deliberations as we're voting on. I don't know if that's acceptable or not.
I'll have that conversation with Ms. Galvin between now and May 3rd, and we'll come prepared to discuss that piece of this, of this plan that's emerging.
All right. Again, good work, and thank you, everybody, for a very robust discussion. This is very helpful. Anything else on the deliverables to the governor's office? Okay. Then future agenda items, number 17.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm wondering, I'm getting a text if there's been any code words.
Well, it has been more than 4 hours and we don't have code words.
I think Ms. Poe is prepared. She's always prepared. So let's go ahead and prompt her for, whatever secret she's been holding close to her.
All right. Well, when you're ready, you can give out the first code word.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The first and only code word for the meeting is April Fools. April Fools.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay, items for future meeting agenda. Hearing none, it is 1:13 p.m. and I hereby adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everybody, for your participation, and thank you for a robust discussion. I appreciate you all.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.